Still kind of experimenting with the best way for me to prepare these lessons. And today, decided to skip the PowerPoint. Mike, you might have to move over. I'm sorry, buddy. The weight of the room is on this side, so I'm going to prioritize them. Can somebody pull that door shut? That'd be great. Thank you. Decided to go with the PowerPoint, or not a PowerPoint, but an old school PowerPoint, what we did before PowerPoint, a whiteboard this morning. Let's start with prayer. Let's get started. Father, we give you thanks for your goodness to us. We thank you for especially the scripture that you give us. We're thankful for the New Testament in particular this morning, and especially these four most wonderful books on earth, the Gospels. And this morning, the Gospel of Matthew especially. Father, I pray that you would bless us as we spend time this morning talking about Matthew, talking about its detail. I'm talking about the way that it presents your Son, Jesus Christ, to be the Messiah of Israel, and even your Son. Father, I pray that you bless us this morning by your Spirit. Amen. All right, I've got a few handouts. Laura, do you mind with these? Thank you. Okay, so if you can pull up all the lights, it might be helpful. Thank you. That's great. So before we get started this morning on the details of Matthew, I wanted to just do a little bit of review from last week. Last week we sort of did an introduction to the Gospels. And of course, this class that we're doing this spring is an overview of the New Testament, book by book. We've covered the Old Testament over the last several years, and today we're going to this spring we'll be focusing on the New Testament books. Last week we discussed the Gospels. We began to discuss their content, some of their differences. Anybody remember some of the ancient Christian symbols that are associated with each Gospel that we talked about last week? What is the symbol for Matthew? Anybody remember? A man. There you go. So Matthew, man. What about Mark? Yes, the eagle. Bull, sort of close. Lion. Yes, Mark's the lion. All right, so Matthew is the man because Matthew focuses on Jesus' humanity, on his connection to the Israelite story. He is the true Israelite. That's Matthew's basic argument. Mark is the lion because in Mark, what is Jesus presented as, especially? The Lion of Judah, and he's a king, right? Mark is the lion is a royal symbol in Mark. Jesus is especially presented as the Davidic king. He's not so much speaking, he's going around doing things, right? He's fighting Israel's enemies, Satan and sickness and death, and vanquishing them, revealing himself finally on the cross to be the true crucified king. We talked about Luke. What is the symbol for Luke? Ox. Yeah, ox. So Luke is the ox. And why is that? Why is Luke the ox? The ox is a dumb beast, right? He's a beast of burden. And Luke really focuses on Jesus' humility, his care for the outsider and for the poor, the upside-down nature of the kingdom that he's bringing. Think about the Magnificat that occurs in Luke, about how the rich are being brought down, the poor lifted up. Everything is changing. Those on the outside are being brought in. And so that's the Gospel of Luke. All right, what about the Gospel of John? Matt said it earlier. He's got it. Eagle. All right. So why is John the eagle? It's great. Yeah. John is doing two things simultaneously. He's really giving this sort of epic scale, right? He starts, in the beginning was the Word, right? This evocation of Genesis 1. And yet he's also this really intimate sort of, John is all about Jesus' intimate private conversations, like with Nicodemus and the woman at the well, and finally his teaching to his disciples that he gives on the night before his death. It's all this, it's a real intimacy, but also a sort of broad scope of Jesus' the reality. He's not only Israel's Messiah, he's also the Logos. He's also the Word made flesh. He is the Son of God, God himself, God incarnate. Okay, so that's sort of a reminder of the four Gospels in general. Today we're going to dive into Matthew. Before we do, though, I want to spend a few minutes talking about this question of when the Gospels were written. This is an important question. I don't have it on the board, but you've got it on your handout here. So when were the Gospels written? I think that's an important question for us as we come to them. And it's important, I think, primarily for a particular reason. Anybody have a sense for what that reason might be? Why would it be important that we think about when the Gospels are written? Exactly. Yes, it is so crucial that the Gospels be eyewitness accounts of Jesus' life. Either direct testimony from people who lived with Jesus, who walked with him, who heard him speak, or people who spoke to others who had that experience and collected their testimony and assembled it into documents. Matthew and John both claim to be eyewitness accounts, right? They're both written by apostles themselves, Matthew or Levi, and then John, of course, one of the innermost apostles. And then Mark and Luke, though not apostles themselves, are written from eyewitness testimony. Traditionally, Mark is understood to be based on the testimony of Peter, whereas Luke is based upon probably a number of different testimonies. He's the historian that's collected them together, but Mary is definitely a primary source for Luke. Okay, and so that's a really crucial question because it really speaks to the authority of the gospel accounts themselves. Right? Is this just hearsay? Is this just rumor or speculation about Jesus' life? Or are the things that are recorded in the gospels actually the eyewitness testimony of people who observe them? Are they trustworthy? That's a very important question. Okay, so in the early church, the Gospels were assumed to have been written in the period after Jesus' resurrection, right? It just seemed obvious. That's what they were claiming to be. That must be what they were. However, in the rise of the historical critical method in the 19th century, which was this method that tried to really understand, you know, based on things like linguistics and the usage of words and syntax, to try to go back and date text based on how language is being used at that time in other texts. There began to be this assumption that, no, the Gospels are probably written much later, at least after 70 AD, and maybe even as late as 100 or 120 AD. And part of the reason for that was because of the way that the Gospel writers give Jesus words that so accurately depict the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD. Right? Much of what happens in the Gospels is not independently verifiable from other sources, right, historically. But the Gospels do speak about Jesus' prophecies regarding the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD, which would have been one of the most significant historical events in the ancient Near East world at that time, in the Middle Eastern world. Everyone knew when it happened, right? It was really obvious. It was a significant historical event. And so the logic goes, well, Jesus so accurately predicts the destruction of Jerusalem. Therefore, the Gospel writers must have waited till after the destruction of Jerusalem and then crafted these accounts and put those words in his lips so that he appears to be authoritative. Does that make sense? That's basically the law. And there are other arguments too, some of it based on linguistic usage. For example, Matthew uses the word ecclesia for the church, and that's not a word that is seen in other texts until sometime around the year 100. And so the idea is, well, that's a late word, and it must have been that must mean that Matthew was written late, and you begin to date the other Gospels accordingly. So that was the argument. Then in 1976, John Robinson, who was actually a pretty liberal guy and pretty progressive guy in general, he wrote a book called Redating the New Testament that really led to a sea change in New Testament studies in the academic world. And in this book, he pointed out this. I've got a quote for you there in your handout. He said, "One of the oddest facts about the New Testament is that on any showing would appear to be the single most datable and climatic event of the period, the fall of Jerusalem in AD 70, and with it the collapse of institutional Judaism based on the temple, is never once mentioned as a past fact." And this is a different way of looking at the same evidence, right? Basically, Robinson said, what if we've been looking at this evidence wrong all this time? What if the fact that the historic record of the temple's destruction is not so much evidence of fabricated accounts that put those words on Jesus' lips, but actually, if you were a gospel writer in 80 AD, what is one of the things that you would be sure to talk about to verify Jesus' status as a prophet? You could not talk about the destruction of Israel, right? You would have to say, look, here's extra proof that Jesus was a prophet of Israel, that he is the new temple. The temple is now no longer here, okay? So Jesus is the true Israel, right? And so Robinson basically said, what if we just step back and look at this from a different direction? What if the lack of the historical record is regarding the destruction of the temple is actually evidence for an early date of the Gospels, and even, he would say, the whole New Testament, because nowhere in the New Testament is the temple's destruction presented as past event. Always, it's talked about as something that will happen, is sure to happen, but has not yet come yet. Does that make sense? Okay. So if you take that, you begin to date the Gospels earlier, at least before 70 AD, which I think is a very, and that really is where now modern scholarship has gone with the dating. There's still some, you know, more progressive secular scholars that would look to a late date, but basically the whole evangelical world agrees that, generally speaking, the Gospels at least were written before 70. My own opinion is that the Synoptic Gospels were written even earlier than that. Maybe in the 30s or early 40s, by the latest, I would say. And part of the reason I think that is this. First, I've got this here in your handout. Remember that the Jewish religion, the Hebrew religion, the Israelite religion out of which Christianity came, was always, always, always a religion that was centered on what? Books, right? Written documents, right? From the very earliest beginnings, when the people are called out of Exodus, what does Moses understand to be one of his primary tasks? Writing the scriptures, right? Not just telling, not just passing down oral tradition, but actually compiling documents, putting together the Torah, the Pentateuch, the five books given to Israel. It was a record of their history, their life together, even their beginning in the book of Genesis, right? From the very beginning and all throughout the Hebrew Israelite religion, the written word, not simply oral tradition, not simply charismatic figures, but actually the written word was central to their identity as a people. So why wouldn't the apostles undertake the writing of the Gospels as one of their first acts? I think that's a question. If you're going to think about the dating of the Gospels, you really have to, for some reason, the burden of proof always seems to be, well, the Gospels were probably as late as possible. Right? And I just don't understand why that is. Why can't we say the Gospels were probably early, and if we're going to put them later, we have to find evidence to that effect? That would be my starting point, would be the Gospels were written early, and we would need to find evidence for them to be late instead of the other way around. And I think there's this really interesting story in Acts 6, right, where the apostles, rather, there's a lot going on in the church. The church is exploding in terms of its growth in Jerusalem. And this is where they have these men, right, that they appoint, the seven men, one of which is Stephen and Philip and others, right, the appointing of the seven to serve tables and to care for the church. And they say they want to do that so they can focus on the ministry of the word and prayer, right? Ministry of the word and prayer. Now, sometimes we think about, well, that means that, well, the apostles were going to, they needed to go out and preach the gospel, right, and pray. So they needed these men to come and, you know, to take care of the church in terms of its physical needs, which there may be some of that going on, but it's really interesting because anybody know what happens in Acts 7 and Acts 8? What are the two of those seven men that are appointed at that time, Stephen and Philip in particular, what are they immediately presented as doing? Preaching, right? There's no indication that they're organizing fund drives for the widows. I mean, maybe they're doing that too, but the main thing that they're talked about doing is preaching, right? Philip is going out and preaching. That's how he meets the eunuch. Stephen is preaching the gospel. That's why he gets killed, because he won't stop preaching about Jesus as Israel's Messiah. So I can't prove this, but I would just say, I think one way to take Acts 6 is to say, perhaps one of the things the apostles were doing was saying, we need to write this stuff down, right? We just had the most incredible experience with Jesus of Nazareth, right? His death and resurrection, we now realize he is Israel's Messiah. He is the Son of God. We need someone to write this stuff down. And so perhaps at that point, Matthew was appointed to that task. To me, if I were establishing a church, that's one of the first things I would want to do, would be to create a written record because of the way that the written word was held and esteemed in Jewish culture, but also just in that culture at the time. And I'll just say this, in favor of Matthew being written first is, and not Mark, is the consistent testimony of the early church. The Gospels are put in the canonical order according to the how the early church understood them to have been written, Matthew, Mark, Luke, then John. And I would also say, also in favor of Matthew's priority is the fact that Matthew, of the three synoptics, is the only synoptic gospel that is understood to be based on firsthand eyewitness testimony, right? Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Mark and Luke are both relying on other people's testimony. Matthew is relying on his own memory. And so, to me, that would be, you know, it seemed like the first gospel that the church would produce would be one that would be written by an apostle who had seen it with his own eyes. So just something to think about. I can't prove that Matthew is written first, but I think there's good evidence for that. Okay. Any real quick questions? I want to make sure we have time to jump into the details of Matthew. Yes, sir. Yes. Yes. I think that's a really anachronistic sort of argument, basically. Yeah, the idea that anything early is short and anything later is more complex, and it just seems to me to be, yeah, just really just based on some modern assumptions that I don't necessarily agree with. Yeah. Does that make sense? Like, yeah. I mean, it could be. I'm not going to stake my life on Matthew written first. Maybe Mark was first. But I just think this idea that anything that's shorter is earlier, and anything that's more complex is later. It just seems to me to be a flawed, based on some flawed assumptions. I need more evidence than that. Yeah. Right. Yeah, it's true. Yeah. Yeah, I think it was Woodrow Wilson had this great quote. Someone asked him, how long does it take you to prepare a speech? And he said, well, it depends how long it's going to be. You know, if it's going to be a 10-minute speech where I really encapsulate everything I want to say about my political strategy and, you know, my vision for America, it's going to take me about 3 weeks. If it's going to be a 20-minute speech, it's a little more expansive. It'll probably take me about a week. If you're willing to let me talk for 45 minutes, I'd do it right now. Right? Which I think is actually a really, really true, really accurate. Okay, so let's talk about Matthew. Okay, so a few things about Matthew I've written down here on your handout. Matthew is Levi, basically Matthew and Levi are the same names for different people. Matthew was a tax collector. We hear about his calling in Matthew 9. He's listed as an apostle in Matthew 10 when the apostles were sent out. His name is Levi, which probably means that he's part of what tribe of Israel? The Levites, right? Matthew's probably a Levite. Almost certainly, one would think, which means, well, he should be doing what? Yeah, should be a priest or part of the priestly tribe, right, serving in some way. Instead, he's a tax collector, which, you know, is part of the contrast of his, the scandal of his life before Jesus calls him. Matthew is the longest gospel by the number of chapters, but actually is the second longest in terms of actual text. Luke, actually, if you take out your English Bibles, Luke will actually take more pages than Matthew. But because of the way that we, you know, the chapter divisions are all later and artificial to some extent. So Matthew's the longest by chapter, but second longest by actual number of text. One of the most important things about Matthew is his relationship to the Old Testament. If you know anything about the Gospels, you know that Matthew is one of the Gospels that really focuses on the significance of the Old Testament and how Jesus is the fulfillment of the story of the Old Testament. That's one of the most obvious things about Matthew. And one of the ways that you see this, of course, is that Matthew many times will say, actually, he'll say explicitly, and this happened to fulfill what was said in the scriptures or in the prophets, right? And he will introduce an Old Testament quotation with that explicit fulfillment formula. And that's something that is distinctive to Matthew. And he is really trying to, and this, again, this would make sense. If you're going to write the first gospel, and your audience at this point is largely Jewish in terms of the evangelism you're doing, what are you going to try to persuade the Jewish people of? That he is the Messiah, right? That your entire story of Israel has culminated in this man, right? That would be your focus, and that is absolutely what Matthew is trying to do. He is very clearly writing for a predominantly Jewish audience that knows the Hebrew Scriptures. He assumes a deep knowledge of Israel's story, and he's writing from that perspective. Okay, so Matthew's overall purpose is to show that Jesus of Nazareth and his birth, life, death, and resurrection is the promised Messiah of Israel, right? He's the fulfillment of Israel's story, and that he is As a part of that, he's greater than Moses. He's greater than all these other figures, Joshua, David, etc., all the prophets. He is not only greater than in terms of like he's their rival, but he is their culmination. He's what they've been pointing to. He is the fulfillment of them. And that Jesus is also God with his people. Matthew is not going to do as much as, say, John will do in terms of Jesus' divine identity, but he is certainly going to begin to introduce that reality in various ways. It's going to be a little more subtle than the way that, for example, John will make claims about Jesus' identity as the divine Son of God. But it's also there, and it's there especially in this context, that Jesus is God with his people, right? Jesus is Emmanuel. Right? It's the name that's given to Jesus in Matthew 1, right? Okay, so let's look. I think this is actually, one of the reasons I wanted to do this was I think this chart is actually a pretty helpful visual way of imagining the content of Matthew. Okay, so for Matthew to start, we have, if you think about this sort of three-layer chart, the beginning on top, we have introduction, okay? And then we have these five different components of the main text of the book, and then a conclusion, which is the last few chapters, focusing on Jesus' death and resurrection, okay? So introduction basically is birth, childhood, you know, early childhood, early part of his ministry, and then five different components, which we'll talk about. And one of the reasons that we do this is that where we see five blocks within Matthew's text is that we have in Matthew 7, 28, in Matthew 11, 1, right? This is the end of the first, 11, 1, into the second, and 13, 53, end of this one, 19, 1, I dated that a little, put 20 there, but you could do it otherwise. And 19:1 and then 26:1, you have the same formula. Matthew will say something like, after Jesus finished speaking these words, after Jesus finished this teaching, after Jesus finished saying these parables, right? And then something else happened. So there's this big block of text, of teaching that Jesus gives in each one of these five components, and then this customary conclusion that Mark has. After Jesus had finished these sayings, then they went to this place. Does that make sense? So this is not just a, you know, oh, this is a great way of dividing up Matthew in terms of topics, but there are also actually literary linguistic reasons for thinking that Matthew is embedding this kind of structure within his gospel. Okay, so, and I would say that really what Matthew's doing in each of these different components is trying to show Jesus' connection to the Old Testament story. So let's think about the introduction. Matthew, of course, begins with the genealogy. Where does Matthew begin his genealogy? Abraham, right? Luke traces the genealogy back to Adam because his goal is something else. But Matthew's goal is to show that Jesus is a true Israelite or is the true Israelite. And so he goes to Abraham, right? The one who God called out to form the people of Israel. Okay, so he starts with the genealogy. Then he goes to the birth. And at the end of the, you know, when the angel appears to Joseph and talks about why he should not turn away Mary, even though she's pregnant and he's confused, right? He says that Jesus is there to call his name Emmanuel, that Mary will have a child, that it's by the Holy Spirit. Her name is to be Emmanuel. And then Matthew introduces this. This was to fulfill what the prophet said, right? Where does Matthew go with that quote? Isaiah 7, right? That the virgin shall conceive and bear a child. He connects it to the Old Testament story here. Then we have the story of the Magi after Jesus' birth, right? The Magi come, the nations come, which is a fulfillment of Isaiah 60. Isaiah 60 talks about the nations coming on camels. People are going to come and worship the true servant of Israel. And then we have Jesus after he's born through the machinations of Herod. There's a plot against Jesus, and Matthew's the only one that talks about this. And so where does Jesus go after he's born? Where do his parents take him for safety? Egypt, right? And then later, God brings them back. And Matthew says, and this was to fulfill what the prophet spoke by the prophet Hosea, out of Egypt I called my son. Which is actually a really interesting quote, because what is Hosea talking about there? Is he talking about a person? Yeah, he's talking about Israel, he's talking about a group of people. But Matthew says this was about Jesus, right? That this is actually, Jesus is fulfilling this. And then you have the baptism and the wilderness. Just think about this for a moment, right? Especially these last three stories. Think about how they imitate the life of Israel, right? Israel goes down in bondage to Egypt, out of the promised land into Egypt for a period of time, and then she's called back up, right? That's what happens to Jesus. And they leave the promised land and go to Egypt originally, Jacob and his sons, because they're hungry, because they're starving, they're going to die. They have to go to Egypt. Same with Jesus. He has to go to Egypt, or he's going to die. After a period of time, God calls him up out of Egypt. What do the Israelites do as they get out of Egypt? What do they do? What do they have to cross? Red Sea, if they go through water, right? Okay, now it's the Jordan River, it's not the Red Sea. But Jesus, after he comes out of Egypt, beginning of his ministry, he goes through the Jordan River, right? And again, of course, Israel has to go through the Jordan as well to go into the Promised Land when she returns to Canaan, right? So Jesus goes through, either you want to see it Red Sea or you want to see it Jordan River, he goes through the water in baptism. And then what happens after they go through the Red Sea for Israel? They end up wandering, right? What does Jesus do after he goes through baptism? Goes through the wilderness. How long is Israel in the wilderness? 40 years. How long is Jesus in the wilderness? Okay. And what happens after, in chapter 5, after Jesus goes through the wilderness? Where does he go then? Up on a mountain, right? I mean, we're getting just pretty explicit here, right? What does God do with Israel after they come out? He goes up on a mountain, and he gives them the law, right? And so that's exactly what's happening here. So you just see how the story of Israel is being rehearsed in the life of Jesus. So 5-7 is, of course, the Sermon on the Mount. Okay, this is the section of Matthew where Jesus, very early in his ministry, goes up on a mountain, the people come to him, and he gives them the law. Now, this is both like and unlike the story of Moses, because when Moses goes up on the mountain, what is Moses doing? Is he giving the law? He's receiving the law, right? So Moses goes up on a mountain, he receives the law, he's just a conduit for the people of Israel, right? The Ten Commandments are written with God's own hand, God's very direct, it's dictated to Moses, all of it. But that's not what happens with Jesus, right? Jesus just goes up on a mountain, he doesn't have some vision, he doesn't have some divine revelation that he tells people about, he just opens his mouth, right? He just starts talking. That's a profound claim about even his identity, right? That he is the greater Moses. Now it's important to remember that when Jesus gives this new law, in the Sermon on the Mount, he's very explicit, right? He's not doing it to abolish the law of Moses. He's not setting the law of Moses aside, but he's giving the fulfillment of it. And if you think about the Sermon on the Mount, that's exactly what the law of Jesus is, the Sermon on the Mount is. It is a more mature, fulfilled form of the Mosaic law, right? He'll say things like, Moses said, right, you should not commit adultery. What do I say? Well, if you've lusted after a woman, you've committed adultery in your heart. Right, he's expanding the scope of the law. He does that. That's just a paradigmatic example of how Jesus does that in all sorts of different ways with all the teaching of the Sermon on the Mount. The Sermon on the Mount is an expansion. It's going to the heart. It's the mature form of what the Mosaic law was all about. Does that make sense? Okay, so Jesus is building on it. He's actually teaching about this kingdom that he's going to bring. That's the first thing he does. And again, remember, Matthew, the image is the man. Jesus is the one who speaks. Jesus is the one who gives this teaching, and that Jesus is the teacher in Matthew. Okay, so after Sermon on the Mount, chapters, and then we have this fulfillment. After Jesus finished these sayings, they went on, they left. So 8-10, we have the second section. Here, I think, Jesus is sort of being compared to Moses/Joshua. There's an element here of that. And there's several reasons for that. One is that here, Jesus begins to establish his kingdom. Matthew 8 and 9 are focused on stories of how Jesus then does battle with sickness and infirmity. He heals people that are sick. He gives sight to the blind, right? He makes people walk that are lame. He does all these things. He's battling against the effects of the fall, right? He's battling against demons. He's casting out demons. Demons are fleeing from him. He's going out. He's establishing his kingdom. He's ruling over nature. He's stilling the storm. When the disciples are there, and he's even beginning to raise people from the dead. So you can see how Jesus is beginning to establish his kingdom, right? Jesus' kingdom is one of shalom. It's one of the reversal of the effects of the fall. It's a place of healing and peace. And then in chapter 10, he does this really interesting thing. Jesus gets his apostles around, right? His 12, what an odd number for him to choose, right? He gets his 12 around, and what does he tell them? He says, I want you to go do what I've been doing. Right? You've been watching me cast out demons and heal the sick and do all these different things, preach the good news of the kingdom. I'm going to send you to do it by twos. And where does he send them? To the nations? Israel, into Israel, into the promised land. Who sent 12 people into the promised land to spy it out? Right? Moses. Joshua is one of those spies. Who leads Israel in taking the promised land and establishing shalom for, or, you know, it wasn't perfect, but that was the goal, establishing the new kingdom in the land of Canaan, the land of promise. It was Joshua, right? Jesus is being presented here as the new conqueror, the new Joshua that is going into the land and taking what is his, really, as the true Israelite. Okay, and again, after, so 10 is this long extended teaching from Jesus where he's telling his disciples to go, or his apostles, his 12, to go into the land, and he's telling what's going to happen to them. They're going to be persecuted. It's going to be hard. You know, I mean, there's a lot of different things. And then he concludes that teaching with 11:1 after Jesus finished these saying, you know, something else happened. All right, they move on. Okay, 11 to 13. We have this passage here, I think, where David is being compared to, Jesus being compared to David, but also even more primarily to Solomon, I would argue. And you can see how we're moving through Israel's history here, right? So 11 to 13 emphasizes some of the different responses to the kingdom that Jesus is establishing, right? It begins with the passage where John the Baptist is sending messengers, and they're saying to Jesus and his disciples, are you the one that is to come, or is there another, right? Are you the Messiah of Israel? So John the Baptist is confused. Some of the people are expressing faith, right? They're believing in Jesus. They're rejoicing in his kingdom. And then there are the leaders of Israel. And how are they beginning to respond, you think? Not well, right? They're threatened. They're frustrated. In Matthew 12, there's this big debate about the Sabbath, right? And how Jesus is breaking the Sabbath law. And who does Jesus appeal to in Matthew 12 for his, quote-unquote, breaking of the Sabbath law? Anybody remember? When they're taking the grain? David, right? He says, didn't David do this? I can do it, right? And then in Matthew 13, Jesus tells a bunch of what? What does he tell in Matthew 13? Anybody know? Parables, right? Matthew 13 is where you really see back-to-back-to-back parables. They're all parables about the kingdom. And remember, parables aren't just simply like sermon illustrations that are most supposed to make people, you know, understand things better. Actually, often they're the opposite. They're to be confusing. They're to create a situation where you need to be wise in order to understand, and that's exactly what the Proverbs are, right? If you read the book of Proverbs, you begin to quickly realize these are not just simple, like, you know, simple sayings you just go out and put into practice. Like, they're actually complicated, and some of them seem to conflict sometimes, and you have to be wise in order to really use them well. Jesus is operating here like Solomon. He is beginning to speak in parables to the people of Israel so that the wise, those whom he's calling, will hear him, and those, the fools, will not, will be separated one from another. Okay, again, long teaching in Matthew 13. After Jesus finished saying these parables, then the action moves on. 14 through 20, I think this is how Jesus is like Elijah, but also even more primarily like Isaiah. And here's why I think this. Okay, 14 through 20, some different things are happening. Continued interaction with the Pharisees, especially. Jesus is continuing to do ministry. But then in Matthew 16, you have this really interesting passage, right, where Peter, Jesus says to the disciples, who do you say that I am? And they throw out some opinions, right? People say you're Elijah. People say you're John the Baptist. You know, you're a prophet. And Jesus says, well, who do you say I am? And what does Peter say? You are the Christ. Right? You are the Christ. You're the Christ of Israel, the Son of God, the Son of the living God. And of course, Christ means what? Messiah, right? You're the Messiah. There's this insight that happens. But immediately after this, what does Jesus do? There's this amazing insight, right? Really, it's been what Jesus has been sort of arguing in his life and his teaching for the last 16 chapters. But then immediately after, Peter says, you are the Christ, the Messiah of Israel, the Son of the living God. What does Jesus immediately start to talk about? His death. Right? It's really fascinating, right? Because what Jesus is doing is saying, yes, I am the Messiah, but I'm not the Messiah you expected, right? I'm not the one that I know that you thought I would be. He begins to talk about how, because he is the Messiah, he will suffer and die, and on the third day be raised again, right? That this must happen. And who is the prophet in Israel's history that talks about the suffering of the Messiah? Isaiah 53, Yeah, all that section of Isaiah, right? Isaiah is the one who introduces this idea of the suffering servant, that the servant, the Messiah, the anointed one to come, he's not going to show up and just kill everybody and destroy all Israel's enemies. No, actually, he himself is going to experience suffering. He himself is going to be destroyed. He is going to receive the judgment for the people. And of course, Peter doesn't like that. We can talk about that some other time. But 17, okay, Transfiguration. Jesus goes up on the mountain. Who appears on the mountain with him that the apostles see? Moses and Elijah, right? Moses and Elijah. You begin to see these connections being made. And then again in 17 and 20, again and again, three times within the space of four chapters, Jesus predicts his death and resurrection. It's not simply after 16, after this confession, but Jesus keeps coming back to it, right? It's like he doesn't really think the disciples get it, because they don't. So he keeps talking about how he is going to be the suffering servant, how his identity as the Messiah means that he is going to be the one who must suffer and die. And I think this really links up well with that prophecy of Isaiah. Okay, and then of course in 18 is where you have this the fourth big block of text here. Jesus is talking about life in the kingdom. He's answering questions from Peter about how many times you have to forgive. He's saying things about if you have, you know, someone else is in sin, here's what you need to do. You need to confront them. You know, Matthew 18, the whole process where we see church discipline. So life in the church is really what Jesus is talking about, the ethics of the kingdom, of the called out group. This is what it's going to look like for you to live with one another. Okay, then, and again, at the end of 18, you have the same, after Jesus finished these sayings, they went on. They went on to Matthew 21 to 25, where I think Jesus is being compared to Jeremiah. Now, what is distinctive about the ministry of Jeremiah? Is Jeremiah well-liked? Is he appreciated by his contemporaries? Oh, they don't like him at all. In fact, they try to kill him many times, right? They don't listen to him. And what is the thing that Jeremiah just... The reason they don't like him, it's not just, you know, he's got a bad haircut or whatever. They don't like him for a reason, and the reason is because he keeps talking about something that drives them nuts. What does Jeremiah keep coming back to again and again? The destruction of the temple, right? Right? Israel, this time in her life, is corrupt, and she's idolatrous and has all these problems, but she's got the temple, and she is putting sacrifices in the temple, so she keeps saying, oh, we've got the temple. God will never let the Babylonians destroy us. We've got the temple, the temple, the temple. And Jeremiah says, oh, you think that's good? That's not good, right? Actually, the temple is going to be destroyed, right? Just because you have the temple doesn't mean that you have God's favor. It's more complex than that. So here, in this section, Jesus is going to be like Jeremiah. He's going to start calling out explicitly the leaders of Israel. He's going to do things like tell the parable of the tenant, which is not a confusing parable. A very clear parable about what is going to happen, right? When the owner of the vineyard sends his servants to go and get the riches from the tenants that he's left the vineyard to, and they first beat them and kill them, and then finally he sends his son, right? And what are they going to do? What do the tenants do when they get the son? They kill him, right? Jesus is talking about himself. He's talking about the history of Israel, and he's doing so in a not very subtle way. He's talking about what's going to happen to him. He's also beginning to talk here about the temple. He goes into the temple and enacts a symbolic destruction, right? He overturns tables. He points out the corruption. He halts the temple activity. And then in 23 to 25, he begins to pronounce woes, right? He says, woe to you, Sadducees. Woe to you, Pharisees. He begins to explicitly pronounce judgment on Israel's leaders. And Matthew 23 is a really fascinating chapter, the way that he really focuses on the judgment that is. It's very much like an Old Testament prophet, and especially like a prophet like Jeremiah. And then after he gets done with all the woes in 23, what does he talk about in 24? Anybody know? How the temple's going to be destroyed. How within a generation, this temple that you see, disciples, it is going to be torn down piece by piece, stone by stone. Okay, exactly the kinds of things that Jeremiah did. Calling out the leaders of Israel, prophesying about the destruction of the temple. And he's got these parables of judgment. So this block, 23 to 25, is then concluded in 26:1, after Jesus finished these sayings. This is Mount Olivet stuff. They went on. And where he went on was 26 to 28, where we see the Lord's Supper, right, of course, the Passover meal, the culmination of Israel's history, and Jesus' own body and blood offered to his followers, his friends. We have the betrayal, which it's interesting, the betrayal Judas's role is really prominent in Matthew. And of course, what does Judas's name mean? Judah, right? Why? I mean, it's not an accident that the one who betrays Jesus is named Judah, right? The tribe that he belongs to, the most prominent tribe of Israel. He's betrayed by his own people, Judah, and the other Israelite leaders. He suffers, he's put on trial, falsely accused and condemned, suffers and finally dies. Right, and so this is the story of how Jesus is now enacting the life of Israel, but he's doing so in a new and surprising way. And of course, the most surprising thing that happens here is Matthew 28. It's not really that surprising from a political perspective that Jesus ended up nailed to a cross. Right? That was the trajectory of his life. It is very hard to imagine of ending in any other way other than maybe revolution or something. But the real twist that happens, right, is the resurrection. The resurrection. And of course, that is the story of Israel as well, right? Because the exile was not surprising, right? The exile is not surprising, but the twist that happens in the story of Israel is Isaiah 66, which talks not only about the suffering servant, that he's the one who is going to die, but also that there is going to be a time of glorious rejoicing and redemption that is going to be brought about through his service and his action, right? Think about the, especially that last section of Isaiah, Isaiah 55, Isaiah 66. It's all about the restoration that the servant is going to bring. And here Jesus in his resurrection is going to begin to fulfill that part of Israel's history as well, in his own self. And then, of course, at the very end of Matthew 28, Jesus gives his final instructions. Go, therefore, to all the nations and baptize them. Make disciples and baptize in the name of the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit, teaching them. And what does he say, right? Teaching them all that I've commanded you, right? Matthew is emphasizing the apostles' role as passing on the teaching of Jesus to those who are going to be made disciples. And then it's really interesting. He ends with this promise, right? He says what? The last words of Matthew. And lo, I'm with you always, even to the end of the age. Which, if you think about it, links up to the first thing that was said about Jesus, right? You shall call his name Emmanuel. He's God with you, God with us, right? Lo, I'm with you always to the end of the earth, right? The end of the age. So you have, I think it's really interesting to see that connection, that the first explicit description about Jesus' identity in Matthew is that he's given the name Emmanuel, God with us. And then the last thing that Jesus says, the resurrected Christ, the one who will never die again, right? The resurrected Christ says, I'm with you always, even to the end of the age. There's this connection between I think that's really where part of it, I mean, you see other ways too, but that's really one of the prominent ways you see Jesus' messianic and even divine identity in the book of Matthew. All right, lots of information on Matthew. We've got time for one or two questions. Yes, sir. Abraham. Right, in Genesis 12. Yeah, Abraham. Yeah, it's great. It's a great point. Yeah, certainly Matthew 28 is a, especially that Genesis 12 promise, you think about that, the blessing to the nations that Abraham was promised to have been. Jesus is now enacting that in himself, and saying it's through him. Absolutely. Yes, ma'am. I don't. Part of the reason is because it was a lot easier for me to draw with my hands than put on a handout. Well, I can. I'll think about how we can turn something into a handout. I don't have it free today, though, but maybe we can work on it. Yes, sir. Mm-hmm. Absolutely, yeah. The fulfillments are not just about arbitrary proof text to prove his divine identity or his messianic identity. It's him. Yeah, they're just dots, data points, as he takes on that trajectory, the story of Israel. And Jesus is not simply the greater Moses in Matthew, but the true Israelite. He takes on all of Israel's story. That's important to see. All right, let's stand and pray. Father in heaven, we thank you for the Gospel of Matthew. We're thankful for Matthew's skill, for his attention to detail, for his crafting of the story to present it in a persuasive way, for Matthew's role even in the founding of the church and his eyewitness testimony and the significant role that it played. But most of all, Father, we're thankful for what Matthew himself points to, and that is the identity of your Son, Jesus Christ, the one who was known as Jesus of Nazareth, the one who is the Messiah, the anointed one, the Messiah even of Israel, who even in his life and death and resurrection revealed himself to be your Son, the one who took up the story of your people upon himself, who suffered for their sin and for ours, and who was raised from the dead for our justification, for our deliverance, for our life. Father, we pray this morning that the Christ to whom Matthew points to would indeed be our life even today, as we are a part of those nations that Jesus spoke about there at the end of Matthew. The gospel has come even to us. Thanks be to God.